Welcome to part three, the final section of our interview with the ZD Wines family. So, Brandon, you're the assistant winemaker.
Yep.
And if you don't mind my asking, I'm just curious how old you are.
I'm 29.
Okay, you look much younger than 29, so we'll just kind of forget that whole section.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, still. Well, young winemakers, I mean, there are a lot of younger winemakers here in the Valley nowadays, aren't there?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's getting passed down, and you're the guys they're going to, right?
Yeah. I mean, for the surviving, you know, family wineries, there's definitely fewer and fewer of them as time goes on in the Valley, but, yeah, we're still out there.
Now, that's an interesting point. Do you really see it that way? Because as I understand with the Napa Valley Vintners Association, but the majority of them are family wineries. But in the Valley as a whole, we know not all the wineries belong to the association. But are you seeing more corporations coming in?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm more on the production side, so my familiarity with the whole other wineries is not as good, but it's definitely, yeah, consolidation throughout the wine industry, through in producers and distributors, all the way through.
You're concerned because you're in a family situation, and you know you want to see that grow. Obviously, you would be the third generation, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, this is something you want to see a future. You're looking to a future of family work, that kind of.
Oh no, absolutely. Yeah, I've been working here for, you know, almost 20 years, if that's unbelievable.
Is that legal?
It's legal if you're family.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that's how they got away with that one. But, you know, I've never thought about doing anything else. I've always been very, very focused, and I've always enjoyed the production side of wine. So, yeah, you know, I can only really speak for myself, so.
Sure. And so, obviously, I would imagine your goal is you want to be the winemaker one day. Again, I don't want to put words
right
in your mouth.
I mean, I've only been, like, I've focused during my career on production, and I definitely enjoy it, but I will go into really any place where I'm most useful to the winery.
So do you make your own stuff?
Well, not really. Pretty much, really? Yeah. I mean, I used to brew beer. I made a lot of wine in my college days, but at this point, once I get home, it's time to work on the house instead of continuing fermentation.
No, that's fair. That's actually a good way to live your life, I would think. I mean, you have to have division between what you do for fun and what you do for life. But you brew beer as well.
Yeah, well, dabbled in it. You know, nothing commercial. But my best friend, he's a commercial brewer up in Humboldt County, Northern California, and so I drink a lot of beer.
Well, don't they say, I've said this 100 times, it takes a lot of beer to make some good wine?
You got it.
Something
yeah.
like that. So, yeah. You know, you're raised in the family of making wine, but was there a point that, you know, it conked you on the head going, yeah, I really want to do this for my life? Or is it just naturally, it was just always there?
Well, I was never really pushed into coming to the winery to work. It was made available to me from a very young age. So I started at 11. That was on the bottling line. And I think it was just mostly from very young age, you know, typical child wants to grow up to be like daddy type scenario. And so I was like, yeah, I want to be a winemaker too. And I always just enjoyed the environment here and the work. So, yeah, I've just never really considered anything else.
That makes good sense. And it's not a bad way to make a living, being in Napa Valley making wine?
Not at all.
Do you do events ever, or is that something you haven't been involved in yet, where you represent as the assistant winemaker?
Yep, they're getting me out more and more as the days go on in terms of, you know, winemaker dinners and just kind of being there in the public eye for tastings, et cetera. So it's definitely part of the gig.
Yeah, I would imagine so. But it is a people business, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's nice to get out once in a while and kind of see some of the faces that you make smile. You know, it's good to get that connection back to the people that enjoy the wine.
And you do make a lot of people smile. And other than that, you're not a bat in a cave. You do need to see daylight once in a while. So you and I, when I first met you downstairs in the cellar, we were talking about this concept with the corks. And for the premium wine, corks versus caps, we know there's problems with corks. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, so, you know, there's obviously multiple alternative closures to natural cork at this point. You know, agglomerated cork, which is the glued together chunks that make a single cork. They have 1+1s, which have a solid end of natural cork kind of surrounding the agglomerated. They have extruded plastic corks, which are becoming more popular. That's kind of the foam-filled plastic. That's what it kind of seems like. Screw caps. And We've experimented with a closure called the Vino Seal, which is essentially a glass closure that has a small kind of plastic O-ring that creates the seal, and then natural cork. I don't think anyone is really going to debate that natural cork is the best closure for prolonged bottle aging of wine, or there, you know, there's always someone to debate, but I think most people would agree. Natural cork has kind of the ideal semi-permeability to oxygen that wine kind of needs for a prolonged period in the bottle. But of course, it goes back to TCA is the main problem. People estimate between 1 and 5% of bottles are contaminated with TCA, which creates that, you know, musty, wet cardboard type character in a contaminated bottle. So, that's going to be the trick, is figuring out how to get cork that is reliably good, because, you know, what we really don't want is someone opening a bottle and saying, this wine doesn't taste very good because of the cork, and then they're not coming back, not realizing that it's actually the cork that's creating that.
Sure. They just see it as being something bad and your name is on it.
Exactly.
Yeah. I want to go back to this glass enclosure. I discovered that about a little over 3 years ago, and it's fascinated the heck out of me. Mm-hmm. Some people haven't even seen it. I've seen it only in whites. Do you think it has any possibility ever making it into reds in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, Whitehall Lane, they've been using it on their Reserve Cabernet for a number of years.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Wow.
So they were the first person that I actually saw use it. I believe Calera is using it on Pinot Noir, at least some of theirs. We've only used it on whites. We've done trials in both red and whites. I think our perception is at this point that it is pretty. What it does to wine, what we saw is a more rapid oxidation than what we saw through a natural cork. I don't know. I like the closure. It looks good. And we put together some sweet packages with it where you had a translucent capsule so you could see all the glass. And it's really cool. But I think for us to adopt it on a larger scale, it would need to be improved.
It is a good-looking enclosure, and I think one of the things I hear universally is the difference between coming to a table in a restaurant and going versus something that at least comes out more elegantly.
Right.
Everybody likes a corkscrew, at least most people do. For lack of a better word, it does have the sexy look,
yeah.
Whereas cork is its own thing. And let's face it, tin isn't sexy.
Right. I know. Me and our marketing team, we all feel the same. It's like, this thing looks cool. And glass is awesome, you know, completely inert. It'd be a good route. But, yeah, we'll see.
We were talking about downstairs about the corks. Explain to me what you were telling me about in terms of the corks and the soaking.
Right. Okay. So all of our corks that come, basically cork is harvested from cork tree in Portugal primarily. And there's extensive testing that the corks will go through getting over to, you know, the California or one of our cork producers from Portugal. By the time it gets here, we'll do a bulk soak, which means we'll take a representative sample of each bale of corks, soak them in wine, smell them to make sure that there's no TCA in there, and we'll also do chemical analysis on that. So that's kind of, we've been doing that for a long time, and my dad kind of spearheaded, you know, more extensive cork testing back in the day. So we've been playing these games for a long time. Kind of what we're getting into right now, which is a newer thing, is called a dry soak. And so what we're doing is taking each cork and individually soaking it briefly overnight in water, and it kind of volatilizes some of these aromas. And what we're looking for specifically is that, you know, TCA. And so we'll go through and smell every single cork individually. And so that will go into either our large format bottles or our premium line, which is called Abacus, which is a Cabernet blend.
So your nose is carrying a lot of weight on it.
You could say that, yeah.
Brandon, if our listeners would like to learn more about ZD Wines online, how would they go about that?
My recommendation would be zdwines.com, and we've pretty much got it all there. But you could also find us on Facebook and, you know, all the normal routes.
Excellent. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you.
I'm here with Joel Belachy of ZD Wines. And what's your position here, Joel?
I do California sales.
Okay. And again, your Robert is your father, Brandon's your brother, and of course, this is all Brett is Robert's brother. I hope everybody's following me on that.
Yes, you got it.
So California sales, what does that mean?
It means I get to go up and down the state to the best restaurants that that there are and drink wine and talk shop.
It's a pretty rough job.
Yeah, it's really rough.
How long have you been doing that?
2 years. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Did you ever have any time before that where you spent a little time in the cellar or anything like that? Or
I did. My brother and I both grew up working on the bottling line. So that's, you know, I guess, let's see. He started when he was 11 or 12. I was a little older. I was about 14. But yeah, summers there all through high school, first couple years of college, a little bit of cellar work, and then, you know, took some time off after school before I came back.
I get the impression that the bottling line is winery hell.
It absolutely is. It's family hazing.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But everybody goes through it.
Yep, exactly. Brett's oldest son, Connor, is getting ready to spend his first full-time summer on the line, so he'll have to do it too.
And he was 15, if I remember correctly, right?
I think he is, yeah.
Well, how many people work on the bottling line usually?
These days, we could probably do it with about 6 people. Back in the day when Brandon and I worked on the line more, it was more like 8 or 9. We didn't used to have a foiler, and so I was the foiler. So as we've gotten better machinery, it takes less people.
Was that actually just dropping the capsule on? So it was done manually.
Yes.
Now the machine does that.
Exactly.
So you're selling wine here in California, and the competition is just growing, I think, since we started the interview. Yeah. So how do you do that?
Well, I am in probably the most fortunate situation of anyone in my line of work in that my family has been doing this job for me for 43 years. So my grandma sold the wine, Brett, you know, has sold the wine, basically everyone in my family has. So me transitioning in has been really nice because everybody knows my family and I just get to come in and, you know, be introduced and get to know people and kind of take them forward on these new vintages. So it is wildly competitive, but we have such a long, rich history that it makes my job a lot easier.
Yeah, I'll bet. History is what it's all about when it comes to wine.
Absolutely.
So generally you're visiting restaurants. Are you also going to retail shops at all or no?
We do a little bit. We focus on, you know, kind of more of the small mom and pop shops. But my main focus is on the restaurants. Mm.
And is there anybody else selling here in California as well, or is that primarily you?
Yes. Well, we have, you know, a sales team. So Brett is in charge of our sales team. Teresa DiRizzio is our VP of sales. Kendra Gillette is our regional sales manager. And then I focus on California, but the entire team is helping out all the time. So it takes us all.
Okay, that makes sense. Are you a wine drinker yourself? I mean, I imagine you have to be.
You do have to be. You know, I grew up drinking the things that everybody in my family would be ashamed of, you know, the things in college that every college, you know, student drinks. But since I've been at ZD, I've been able to drink, you know, aside from a lot of ZD, a lot of other really fun things too. You know, I work very closely with the Henry Wine Group, who brokers our wine in California. And so I get to be exposed to their entire book too, and they have wines from all over the world. So I get to drink, you know, all kinds of really interesting wines. It's really fun.
So you get to do a lot of comparing, I imagine, too. Do you keep notes, or is it just all in your head?
You know, my husband and I always talk about this. We need to be better at keeping notes. We're getting ready. We're studying for our level 1 SOM test. And so we've just started to focus a little more on keeping notes. But it's something that I haven't done until very recently.
Mm-hmm. So explain to me the level 1.
Well, there's several different ways you can go about becoming a certified SOM. We're going to do the test via...
And I should say sommelier just for our listeners, right?
Yes. Sorry.
No, I just want to say it. So just to be clear, it's the word sommelier. So go on.
So there are a lot of different kind of testing facilities you can go through. There's, you know, the W set, the C set. We're going to go through the Court Masters. And that's a really well-known kind of testing facility. Level 1 is really basic. It's, you know, just understanding the wines of the world, the different regions, where grapes from different regions come from, temperatures, that kind of thing. So it's very, very basic. Once assuming I pass this test, I wouldn't be able to call myself a certified sommelier. It's the level below that. So this is just the introduction, just to get more kind of a broad level knowledge. I get very in my ZD bubble, so this is going to be good for me to explore the other rest of the world of wine.
And how far do you plan on going then with that, all the way to the top then?
Not necessarily. No. I do still have to keep going with my full-time job. Level 1 for now. That's really, I just want to have a more broad understanding of, you know, French wines and Italian wines and things like that. If I went all the way to the top, I mean, to become a master sommelier, you have to, you know, do all kinds of ridiculous tests. I mean, I think there are like 40 or something that have passed in the country. And so I will not be going for that.
Well, it's a complicated process. And not only that, but once you start talking about European wines, the game changes. In fact, if anything, we're very lucky here in America because, you know, the wines are named after the grape and that sort of thing. The labeling, forget about it. I mean, you get to Italy and make you lose your mind, let alone France.
Yep.
Do you spend a lot of time drinking European wines anyway, though, just to sort of as experimenting or something you enjoy? Or
it's definitely something I enjoy. I mean, I need to get better about buying more international wines because, you know, being living in Napa and being so California-centric, I'm always looking for wines that people compare to us or that they put us in the same category. So I end up drinking predominantly California wines just to kind of, you know my market better. But I'm definitely excited about drinking more of those as I get ready for the test.
So do you end up here in the Valley? I assume you live here in Napa and there. So do you go to a lot of casual kind of events. Do you end up taking a ZD wine or do you end up taking something you'd want to buy? I mean, is it very, not to put you on the spot.
I know. But when I go to?
Yeah, right.
Oh, I always bring ZD. It's what I was raised doing. My family wouldn't have it any other way.
Was there a time for you when it was like, other than working on the bottling line, which at that time may have been not exactly what you wanted to do, you were like, wow, wine, this is something extraordinary. I want to do this.
Mm-hmm. It did, but you know, it took me a while. My brother's path to ZD was very direct. He never really strayed from it. He always knew it's what he wanted to do. My path was a little different. After working on the bottling line, I was excited about ZD and I was excited about wine and working with my family, but I didn't really know what capacity I would fit into here. And so my dad really just encouraged me to study what I was interested in at school and that things would kind of work themselves out. So I studied clinical nutrition at UC Davis. And after school, I waited tables and I worked at as a teen director at the Boys and Girls Club in Napa.
Oh, cool.
And it was when I was waiting tables, I was working at Bounty Hunter in downtown Napa. And, you know, I was at tables talking about where they should go when they're visiting Napa, and I was spending my entire time talking about ZD. And so that's kind of when I realized I wanted to come back. And so I emailed Brett, and turned out they were looking for a California salesperson, so it worked out.
Nice, good timing.
Yeah.
And not a bad position. The fact you get to do a certain amount of traveling, obviously.
Yep, but quick trips.
And the whole idea of working at a restaurant, I mean, if there's a great, okay, Bounty Hunter, but I mean, still, it's a great place to get a wine education, just working tables, right? I mean, that's where you learn, forward your own education, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, before I worked at Bounty Hunter, there's no way I could have done this job. I mean, my first few shifts, I couldn't walk up to a table and have a conversation with them. So it was not only getting over, you know, opening wine tableside and talking about wine, but just the general nerves and walking up to a table of people that you've never met before. So all those kinds of things really helped me.
Well, wine is, and we've all said this, wine is very social. And obviously, you're a social person. You have to be, because introverts don't sell a lot of wine, do they?
No.
No, that's kind of how it works. So if our listeners want to find out about ZD online, how would they learn about you guys?
Well, they should definitely go to www.zdwines.com or follow our ZD Wines Facebook page.
Excellent. Well, Jill, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you.
To learn more about ZD Wines, visit zdwines.com.
Thanks for listening to this program. Watch for our next podcast featuring Ignacio Blancas, winemaker for Summer's Wines. Cheers.
Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Original music by Tim Turton. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2012.